everyone. I'm C.P. Leslie, the host of New Books in Historical Fiction. Today I'm speaking with John Richard Bell about his novel, The Circumstantial Enemy. Most of the time, I switch from one period and country to another. It's rare for me to interview two guests within a short time who write about the same subject. But World War II was a huge theater, and The Circumstantial Enemy takes a different approach to the topic from Gwen C. Katz in Among the Red Stars. Not the least of these differences is in its main character, Tony Babich, a Croatian pilot who soon finds himself flying missions against the USSR on behalf of the Germans. May 1941, Zagreb, independent state of Croatia. Once the shriek of the steel wheel brakes fell silent, Tony Babich squeezed through the partially open doors of the rail car and dashed toward the parks leading to the city center. His frantic strides soon slowed, but not because of breathlessness. The wooded square's sights, sounds, and smells were messing with a determined mind. The fountains still danced, and the vibrant irises and marigolds, always planted with precision, rippled in the wind. He mopped his brow and shifted his duffel from one shoulder to the other, all the while absorbing the wonders around him. Apart from Wehrmacht vehicles on the street, Zagreb seemed to know nothing of the 12-day invasion. Why would it? This had been Serbia's war, with Belgrade taking the brunt of Hitler's bombs. As Tony considered the notion, his gaze veered to the clusters of leaves that swirled at his ankles and snagged at the cuffs of his uniform. A rumble in the sky and the approach of muddy clouds warned of a downpour. So be it. Whatever the heavens tossed his way could not dampen the thrill of home. And now, please join me in welcoming John Bell. Hi, John. Thanks so much for agreeing to talk with me today.
Carolyn, it's good to be with you today.
So before we get to your novel, please tell us a bit about yourself. You have an interesting story, having spent most of your career in business. You were a CEO, in fact. So what made you decide to write fiction?
That is a long story. I never had a burning desire to be a writer at all. I was a very average student in high school. And then about 15 years ago, my daughter said to me, if you don't write it, his story will be lost forever. She was talking about her grandfather. And her grandfather, for many, many years, has told us about his trials and tribulations in the Second World War. He was a young Yugoslav pilot who eventually found himself conscripted into the side of the Germans. And we heard all about it, and it was extremely interesting. And then when she said, you should really document this for the family, I said, well, you know, I'm not a writer. But she said, well, it doesn't have to be published. All you have to do is interview him and give us this account. So I went to him, and he was 80 at the time, thrilled to do it, and sat down for a matter of a couple of months and did these interviews. And then he told the story. And then I actually did publish the biography, just enough copies for the family and a few generations to come. And then I thought I was done with writing. And about 3 years after that, after the company I was the CEO of was sold to Kraft, and I was consulting, I had plenty of time. I was in airplanes and lonely hotel rooms. And I thought, oh, the basic story is so interesting. If I was to fictionalize it, could I turn it into a thrilling novel? And that's how I got to it. And 10 years later, Circumstantial Enemy was published.
So was that a big shift for you? You had written some nonfiction, I think. You published a nonfiction book.
Yeah, it's a huge step. I got to nonfiction because I found a literary agent who was interested in this project. But he was not a specialist in fiction. But he offered me enough advice to help me improve the book. And then he finally said, you know, John, I've gone about as far as I can with you on this fiction book. I'm selling business books and doing really, really well. I said, oh, I could give you a business book. And he said, well, what would you do? What would you write it on? I said, well, I'd write it on focus. He said, oh, there's lots of books on focus. What would make yours different? I said, yes, people talk about focus. And we understand what focus means, but very few are prepared to actually make sacrifices to find focus. So I wrote this book called Do Less Better, The Power of Strategic Focus in a Complex World. And he sold it to Palgrave Macmillan. So at least I had a book out there. And then I put my energy back into the fiction book. But of course, fiction and nonfiction is completely different genres and completely different audiences. And it did not give me much of a support in terms of finding another agent or a publisher. I just had to work harder at that. But I will say writing fiction was 20 times as hard as nonfiction.
So how did you go about it? What did you do in order to learn fiction?
I started to write the fiction, and I would say maybe after a couple of thousand words, I realized I was in way over my head. I knew nothing about writing a novel. And so I stopped writing for a year, and I went to the library almost every day and read books about how to write fiction. So I read books about character, plot. I even read books about romance, structure, all of this stuff. And a year later, I sat down to write with that in mind. So I learned about the plot arc and had planned out a, you know, chapter by chapter plot arc. And then I started writing, and it, I absolutely loved it. I was completely into it. It was on my mind all the time. And unfortunately, my manuscript was so long. I had no idea that, you know, rookie novelist, you better not write anything for more than 100,000 words, or it just won't be looked at. This was 240,000 words. And over 3 years, using a number of people to help me edit it, I managed to do less better and got and murder some darlings in there and got it down to the right length, which was about 110,000 words, which is what The Circumstantial Enemy is. And learned a lot along the way.
What kinds of things?
Self-learning.
What kinds of things did you learn?
I think the most important and the biggest learning now when I think of it is the fact that I got to know those characters so well, like members of my family, the villains as well as the heroes, that writing what they would or wouldn't do actually became easy. I was surprised that I could take a female point of view in romantic scenes and some other less desirable scenes and be able to do it because I knew the character so well. And, you know, I would have thought that it would be much easier for a guy to write in the male point of view, but it wasn't any easier and it wasn't any more difficult. So knowing the characters inside out, and I think because I was with them for so long, this book was 10 years from beginning to end. From beginning the writing to actually seeing it in the marketplace, and you're still writing, you're still editing, you're still revising and improving and murdering some darlings, as they say, that you thought were pretty nice paragraphs, but unnecessary.
Yeah, that's always a hard one, but it's good practice, I think.
It certainly made the final version extremely tight. I mean, people who understand literature and other authors have said that. And I said, well, I think I just had so much in it that to get it down by 2.5 times, it had to be tight and it had to be succinct without too much puffery.
Yeah, it's remarkable that you were able to cut that much out of it because it's a very rich novel that's left.
If I had it to do again, I would have made it three novels, but I didn't have the experience. And, you know, I thought this would be a great epic novel. Well, nobody wants an epic novel from a rookie, especially someone my age. I mean, that's the other thing. You know, do literary agents, they look at someone at 71 and go, well, how many more books has this guy got left in him? We want to manage careers, not books.
It's true. I'm thinking, I interviewed Laurie R. King along probably almost 5 years ago now. She writes a series of mystery novels. Well, she has several series, but her longest one is about Mary Russell, who is her imagined wife of Sherlock Holmes. And we were talking about how she started working on it. And she said, well, because I was Laurie R. King and not Stephen King, I had to write 90,000 words.
Yeah.
So... and the humor is that she's not quite Stephen King, but she's certainly like in that ballpark. So there's always hope.
I read one in my research. I read King on writing as well. Which actually shocked me because he doesn't do a plot arc. You probably know, he just starts out with a sentence and goes from there.
Yeah, some people do. Some people do.
I'd love to be able to do it.
So let's talk about the circumstantial enemy itself. You mentioned that it's based on your father-in-law's life. And he obviously did talk to you because you interviewed him at length, which is a really interesting. It's a very valuable asset because so many vets, especially of World War II, won't talk about their experiences. But how did you turn him into Tony? Presumably Tony is not just your father-in-law, but a character in his own right.
Yeah, he's pretty close. Tony Babbage is very much like him. He was, this guy was an adventurer. He joined the Royal Yugoslavian Air Force at 18 because he wanted to discover the world. He wanted to have a good time. So it was a complete shock when at 20 the Germans invaded, and suddenly he was defending Belgrade and captured as a prisoner of war and then sent back to Croatia for that meeting with the sergeant, as you remember, where he was interrogated again. And then he was in Russia, this kid who was really apolitical. I mean, he really didn't know what was going on politically in Europe. He just wanted to have a good time. And of course, he was in for a hell of a shock.
And how did he feel about that in retrospect?
Well, he had a tough time with it. I mean, I had Tony Babbage in when he was on the Eastern Front, and they had to manage slave workers. He was stealing food from the cafeteria to feed them, which he would have been shot if he was caught. So he was very, very sensitive and caring as much as he could be to do what was right. Without getting himself killed. And then he was sent back to Croatia to then actually be at odds with his own people because the partisans were rising up against the Germans. But he was on the side of the Germans. So it was again Croat versus Serb, which was a conflict that has been going on for 1,000 years. They did not want to be ruled by the Serbs. He got that because he got that from his father and his grandfather and the one before them, that they were always under the thumb of the Serbs, who came from the Ottoman Empire, different religion. And of course, Croatia was always more aligned with the Austro-Hungarian Empire, same religion and same kind of culture. So they wanted their own country. They wanted their own independence. They didn't get it after the First World War, thought they would. But they felt that the Allies double-crossed them. So again, they were under more Serb rule. And then when Hitler came in, he established the independent state of Croatia, which of course wasn't independent. It was a Nazi puppet state. And the Ustasha, which is means fascist in Croatian, they were the prevailing government. And before he knew it, by 1943, when Italy had surrendered, the Allies were then sending arms and clothing and supplies by way of the sea to Croatia. And his job was to scout that sea. And if they spotted any boats coming, drop the bombs. And of course, he was downed in the sea. And that basically led to him eventually going to prisoner of war camps in the U.S., which was a great way to spend the rest of the war in retrospect. Even though in one of them the Nazis controlled the camp with an iron fist, he had the same rights as did American soldiers who guarded the camp and worked out of the camp because they followed the Geneva Convention, which, of course, the Axis side did not. So he learned English, he learned a trade, and he came back to true Croatia. Of course, by that time, the partisans had taken over the country, and he was an enemy of the state. So that is all true. And then what I did is I fictionalized the circumstances in the camps, his romance with who would become his future wife, and the problems with the partisans that he had in post-war Yugoslavia.
Ah, okay. So the whole first part of the story, through his capture and taking to the camps, is basically your father-in-law's story.
Well, yeah, the locations and the situations are that. But, of course, there's a lot of fiction in there because he's building up conflict with various characters along
right.
the way.
Okay. So that's the part of it that you invented. Obviously, you invented the dialogue and all the rest of it as well. But you...
He is the only true character in the... All the other characters are fictional.
Ah, okay. That's useful
yeah.
to know.
Yeah.
So, how did you research this novel? Because, obviously, World War II, you know, there's a History Channel, there's an enormous quantity of publications and so on, but the war in Croatia is not that much studied in English, is it?
There's not a lot about it. But when you know, I could read about the Eastern Front, I could read about the assault on Leningrad, which is where he was. In Russia. So there's quite a bit written on that. There's actually quite a bit written on the United States prisoner of war camps, of which there were 400 in the U.S. between 1942 and 1946. And they housed as many as 425,000 Germans. There's a lot on the individual camps. I probably read 6 nonfiction books on the U.S. camps, which was really, really helpful. And then I had to make sure that his story was true. And there was a few examples where he'd exaggerated a bit. I mean, they were mainly true, but there was a little bit of exaggeration, but usually on the numbers. In the book, there's something about a soccer game between the Italian and the German prisoner of wars in Rockford, Illinois. And the whole town was excited about it, and they had this game. And I mean, in his mind, there was 40,000 fans there. Well, there wasn't. There was 4,000. But it doesn't much matter. But I had to get it right.
Right. Yeah.
And so I checked and double checked, and I mean, he was 95% right, even at 80. His memory was still pretty good. So that had to be done, and I just knew where to look on these little incidents, and rather than be reading encyclopedias about World War II, didn't have to do it.
So that's good.
And I looked at it more as a thriller novel than I did as a historical fiction, even though there's a lot of history in there that had to be correct. So, but for me, it was really making the story exciting for the reader and believable, and yet at the same time, the message of this little known part of World War II history has come out, and this is what I discovered in the reviews that people appreciated so much. They said, "How can you write anything new about World War II?" Well, if you write about America, Britain, and France and Germany, there's not much new other than little individual stories. So this was new to people. Having said that, this was one of the challenges I had in finding a literary agent in America. And they wanted it to be about an American. And I had one agent, quite a well-known one, who said, I'll take it on, but I want you to start this book at the prisoner of war camp in America. I said, you know, as much as I'd love this book, you to represent me and to have this book come out, I'm going to start. I'll be starting that at the middle of the book. I just can't do it. So he said, thanks, but no thanks.
So let's get back to the interview that you mentioned in Belgrade. I mean, we've just met Tony. He's just come back to Zagreb, and he's had a kind of bad experience flying. He really... I get the impression he's almost thinking about giving up flying, and he's gone down to the local government office to get his identity papers checked, and he runs into trouble. So tell us what happens to him.
Yeah, the reason that's in there is because the Royal Yugoslavian Air Force was made up of a number of factions. It was basically run by the Serbs, but there was also Bosnians, and there was Croatians in there. So what this captain was trying to do was trying to determine his loyalties, whether he was for the Croats or whether he was for the royalists or the communists or whoever. So, I mean, the moment he discovered that he was basically, Tony was apolitical at that time, that he was a Croat and he would be of help to them because he had experience and he was just a young guy, but he didn't have a lot of experience. I mean, he'd been in one or two air battles in a fighter plane and had killed somebody, so he was absolutely shell-shocked by that and just came back not wanting any more war, but, well, there is no neutrality when there's war. So he signed on with them, which was pretty typical, I would think, of someone who was already in the armed forces and came back to Croatia. What are you going to do? Unless you're communist minded, of which his family was not. They were very, very patriotic Croats, wanting their own independence, wanting to run their own country, wanting to be away from the dominance of Serbia.
Although you mentioned that the independent Republic of Croatia was a puppet state, as I think most areas controlled by Germany were at that time, what did it have that appealed to Tony? I mean, I do get the impression that he was something of a Croat nationalist, if not really a political person. I mean, is that the main thing that drew him, besides the fact that he didn't have many options, really?
Yeah, he didn't have many options. He didn't have any options. And I think in the theme you're referring to, the captain said, if you agree, I'll ask whoever the German superior officer is to approve you. Are you good with that or something like that? And he said, yeah, I'm good with it. And then I think I had him think, yeah, now let me get the hell out of here.
Mm-hmm.
Sign off and go and put it behind you. Of course, it didn't last long because then he was off to Russia.
So he has a very close friend named Goran. Is that how you pronounce
yep.
it?
Yeah.
And he takes a different path. Tell us about him.
Yeah, so what happened, and this is part of the original book that I had to pull to get the word count down. I had to pull the first seven chapters and started in chapter 8, and I was able to do that with some revision, but not a lot. And the editor who had looked at the book and said, you know, we've got to cut 40,000 words out of this book if you want to get a bona fide publisher. And she said, are you sitting down? I was on the phone to her. I said, yeah, I'm sitting down. She said, what would really happen if we killed the first seven chapters? I said, really? She says, it seems to me this book takes off in chapter 8. So why don't we just start it there? And let's leave some of the backstory to the imagination of the reader. And at that point in my writing development, I wasn't very good at that. I like to tie things up. I like to cross the T's and dots the I's. She says, you don't have to do that. You have to trust the intelligence of your reader, and this is a perfect opportunity for you to do it. And I think she was right. I mean, you didn't think anything was... You've read the book. You didn't think anything was missing.
I know.
Like a good place to start.
Yeah, it did.
I think. So, but anyway, Goran and Tony had gone to apprenticeship trials to become pilots. They had gone only because it was a free paid holiday for them, where they would go and they would run some tests and they'd check their eyes and they'd see how athletic they were and various things like that. And the Air Force would pay for their train fare to this little town for 3 days. Well, Tony got in and Goran didn't. But so Goran went into academia, and of course Tony went into the Royal Air Force. 2 years later, Germany invades, now is in even deeper. Well, his friend, who's an academic, moves to the side of the socialists and the communists and becomes more interested in supporting that side of the equation. and eventually becomes Tony's enemy from a political standpoint, from a real, probably a realistic standpoint, and from a romantic standpoint, because he's in love with the same woman. So their conflict starts there, and it continues right through the book.
So, yeah, let's talk about Katerina. She is the daughter of a former colleague of Tony's.
Former commander, yeah.
Yes, his former commander, exactly. And they meet at the commander's funeral or shortly thereafter. Tell us about them. These are characters that you made up, as I understand.
Right. So his name was Kirilenko. He was a major. And he gave Tony a very tough time in those pilot trials and eventually came to respect Tony and Tony respecting him. So when the war ended, when they surrendered to the Germans after the 12-day invasion, they were on their way back to Croatia. And the Germans attacked them and Kirilenko was killed. And just before he died, he gave Tony something to give to his wife and daughter. And and so Tony had contacted them and met them in Zagreb. And of course, the daughter was didn't want anything to do with him because she hated the military, because her father was always in the military and he was always under the thumb of the Serb leader. So she immediately didn't like Tony, but there was something there that developed. And Goran, of course, was very attracted to her. So we've got a little bit of a love triangle happening.
And is she equally attracted to Goran?
No. No, but he helps her out of a bad situation, and she feels indebted to him. Pretty much throughout the book. But no, her attraction was to Tony, but it took a while to develop.
I see. All right. So,
without giving too much away.
Right. We'll stop there. So talk a little bit about the forces of Tito. I mean, I actually can't tell anymore how much Americans know about Tito, since I'm a Russian historian. I, of course, know something about him. But this is where he's just getting started, and Goran is supporting him. So tell us a little bit about that element of the story, and then we'll move to the United States.
Okay, sure. So Goran looked at which way the bus was going. And when it looked like the communists were going to take over the country, he was advised to be a part of them sooner than later. So he did, and it worked out quite well for him. He became an individual in charge of passports and visas, and Tito became the I'm not sure whether he was the president. They called him president at that time or not. But anyway, they ruled the country. They sought revenge on anyone who supported the Nazis, of which the Ustasha were the secret police who did. Tony was never part of that group. He wasn't. So he wasn't quite as bad as them. He could come back to Croatia and not necessarily be incarcerated, although he was for other reasons. And then I think there was a bloody revenge for probably a year after they took over, where they chased all of those who were on the other side. And then eventually Tito said, come on, we have to be more worldly. So they stopped that. It was still a police state in some ways. But it wasn't nearly as difficult and as ruthless as the payback of 1946 and part of 1947. So when Tony did come back to Croatia, he was considered an enemy of the state, and a bright future was not there for him. Let's put it that way. I don't think he was ever under the risk of execution, but incarceration, that certainly did happen for a period of time.
What made the Croats support Tito? Because that put them back into yoke with Serbia, which they apparently didn't want.
No, they didn't. They actually didn't support Tito, even though Tito was a Croat. And you can talk to Croats and Serbs even now, and they'll often argue about whether he was a Croat or not, but he was. But he was a communist, and they had the support of Stalin, which the Croats didn't want. But I mean, after that situation, I didn't really know very much about the country, other than it wasn't right for my father-in-law or for Tony Babbage, and he had to get out, which he did. And that part of the story is a little bit different than what actually happened. He never did go to the U.S. He actually went to Africa. But I thought the U.S. would be a better way to take the book and leave the opportunity for some pretty interesting sequels in USA.
Great. So talk to us about the prison camps. You gave us a sort of broad outline, and you mentioned how Tony got into the camps, but what was his life like there?
It was very different. In the first camp was in Rockford, Illinois. And at that point in time, 1943, the American attitude was, what goes on behind the barbed wire is their business, not ours. So they, whatever goes on back there, fine, as long as there isn't escapes and things like that. So the American commanders, they basically had set up people within the camp who ruled the camp as though it was a political party. And at that point in time, when you had Nazi elements, and the camp he was in did, and a number of them did, they were still trying to convert people to the ideals of Hitler and Nazism. So there was things called, you know, the Holy Ghost, which was a midnight trial of prisoners for whatever reason. And in the camp he was in, his barrack, which was made up of a number of non-Germans who were conscripted onto the German side, Poles, Croats, Hungarians. And so they staged a hunger strike. And when there's a hunger strike, the American system is that somebody from the War Department must come. It can't be solved by the camp commander. And that's what the Geneva Convention states. So somebody came from the War Department and said, you know, what's going on with you guys? And he said, we're living under Nazi terrorism here. We're not Germans. We don't want to be with them. So they moved them down to a camp that didn't have Nazi elements in Louisiana. But shortly thereafter, you may know the name Leon Jaworski.
Yes.
From Watergate. Leon Jaworski was in the War Department, and he's the guy that said, we have to change our point of view here. We are going to, when this war is over, we'll be putting over 400,000 Germans back on European soil. We better teach them something about democracy. We have to get these Nazi elements out. So they cleaned it up, and they gathered most of the Nazis and put them in camps just for Nazis and helped others understand and appreciate democracy, which was fantastic for Tony Babbage and my father-in-law. Because this is where they learned to trade, they learned how to read, they learned English, a lot of super benefits, and they were fed extremely well and treated really, really well. So in some ways, in a lot of ways, this was the way to spend the rest of the war, in a POW camp in America, not in one in Europe.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I was really surprised at the attitude of the authorities early in that first prison camp. I hadn't expected that they would be so hands-off.
Yeah, I think it came on them so quickly. The Brits had about 60,000 Germans in England in these camps. So Churchill went to Roosevelt and said, look, you've got to help us out here, as well as Canada. And so they gave them a kind of a format for how to do it. None of those camps would take more than 4,000. prisoners. So they were a certain size, controlled. Usually they were away from the ports so that, you know, they couldn't escape. And it was all so new. And then who do you hire to manage these people? So they went and they got a bunch of retired army people to do this, which was a completely new job. I mean, it was a little bit easier in places like Camp Grant, where you already had a big American base in Illinois. But like a little town in Louisiana, the one my father-in-law was in was called Ruston, Louisiana. Completely a new deal. So they cleaned it up pretty quickly. I think it was maybe about a year of this trouble. And then they tried to take the Nazi elements out of those camps. Very interesting part of American history, and so few people know about it.
Well, I think at the time it was actually forbidden to be spoken about. And the only reason I know about them is because I interviewed another author who had written a historical fiction novel set in a German, U.S. POW camp up in Wisconsin. And she mentioned that she had actually found newspaper reports and things like that that said that it was illegal to talk about the prisoner of war camps. Why that would be, I'm not sure. But
The interesting thing is there was very few escapes. I think I'm going by memory, and I read a lot of books about it, under 10.
That is
so
amazing.
I mean, that one in Louisiana, the nearest town was Shreveport, which was about 250 miles away. How do they get there? They're in overalls with PW on the back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no transportation. So they didn't make it easy for them. And I think, to be honest, a lot of them, why would they try to escape?
Right.
Unless you were such an ardent Nazi that you wanted to cause trouble with the enemy. But guys like Tony Babbage and the non-Germans, no, waiting out the war,
right,
making the best of it. And then Uncle Sam gave them some money to go back. They got so much per month because they, you know, they worked in nearby factories and cotton fields, and so they went back with a fair amount of money for the times, especially if you were in Croatia.
Did your father-in-law want to go back?
Yeah, he wanted to go back. He wanted to go back, but he didn't want to go back to a country ruled by the communists.
Mm.
But he pretty much had to.
Yeah, no, I know he didn't have a choice, but choosing and wanting are two different things.
Yeah, right. I mean, the Russians who had deserted and gone over to the Germans, who were then captured and put in U.S. camps, they begged not to go back. They said they would work for nothing because they knew they would be assassinated when they got back to Russia. And they did everything they could. But they had to go back. That was the deal that Stalin made with Roosevelt. These Russians would be repatriated. And I guess at the time, it was something that Roosevelt had to go along with for the better of the rest of them.
So one of the big events in the camp was the soccer game that you mentioned, the one that had 4,000 spectators, which is actually still a lot for Rockport, Illinois, in the middle of a war. And somehow Tony again finds himself on the wrong side. Tell us how that happens.
Well, the ardent Nazis who controlled the camp were so committed to Hitler that the thought of losing a soccer game to the lowly Italians was incomprehensible. They had to have a superior team, but the Italians had some semi-pro players on the team. So when Tony Babbage arrived, the commandant, Major Maurer, he interrogated everyone for two main reasons. One, to try to get them on the side of Hitler again, and secondarily, to find out if they knew how to play soccer. And Tony Babbage was a great soccer player, so he wanted him to play for Germany. He did not want to play for Germany, but there was, again, a deal he made. because, Maro's gang of thugs were giving his barracks a pretty bad time and interrogating people, taking them out at night, all kinds of terrible things. And so Tony said to him, look, I'll play for you, but, we're off limits. You leave my barrack alone. And there might have been some other considerations, which I won't reveal, but they're in the book. So that's the deal he cut. And then he also decided that he was a bit of a mercenary. So, if he was to score some goals, what would happen? Bottom line is he did, and they did win. But the American press, the Rockford press in the area, interviewed the team, and they found out that it was a Croat, not a German, who scored the winning goal, which was this is just a horrific revelation for the Nazis, who wanted to take all the credit. So that that camp commander became a much bigger adversary of Tony Babbage, and so the conflict accelerated within that camp.
So how did you come up with your title, The Circumstantial Enemy? Perfect title.
I had a number of titles, but he was there through circumstances, the wrong place at the wrong time. Happened to be in the Air Force, not because he wanted the career of a military man, because he wanted to explore from the heavens and see the world. And suddenly, for some reason, there was this war, and now he was on the side of the bad guys. And when you're on the side of the bad guys, you're on the side, you're offside with a lot of people, which included his own countrymen, the partisans, as well as the royalists. This was the military, the kingdom of the monarchy that ruled Yugoslavia. And then, of course, the Americans and the Brits and a lot of people. And then when he came back, his own people again. So he was in this war by circumstance. And so he was the enemy of a lot of people, circumstantially. So I thought it's a long word, but it probably describes the situation as best I can.
It certainly does. So what would you like readers to take away from The Circumstantial Enemy?
Oh, the takeaway. Okay, so, but I figured you were going to ask me that question. And if you don't mind, can I read what a reviewer said?
Please do.
Okay, so this reviewer said this was a deeply human story. The characters did not always see eye to eye, but the reader can fully understand why each one acts in the manner of their choosing. The reader may not even agree with these choices, but the book never makes you feel like you have to. Regardless of right or wrong, or what is moral, the narrative remains neutral and allows a story to be told. It's sad and tragic, but at times uplifting and inspiring. This is a book for people who have an interest in history, especially World War II history, but also for those who understand that the world is never a black and white place when it comes to morality and the individual. So I thought that reviewer kind of summarized it pretty well. I wish I'd have thought that way when I wrote the book, but I think that's the upshot of it.
Congratulations. That's an amazing review.
Yeah, it was quite a detailed one. That's just the part at the end. So I thought that might answer that question for you.
Sure. So what about you? Are you working on another novel, or is this it for you in fiction?
Well, this is an interesting dilemma right now. I am going to write something else, but here's my issue. I have 7 chapters already written, but that's at the beginning. So the question is whether I do a prequel and maybe do something more on the other characters within those 7 chapters, or just cut to the chase and go to America, which is where you eventually ended up, and go from there.
Thanks so much for sharing your time with us today.
Thanks for having me. All the best.
And thank you for listening to our podcast. Once again, I'm C.P. Leslie, and today I've been talking with John Richard Bell about his debut novel, The Circumstantial Enemy. You can find out more about him at www.ceoafterlife.com. Like us on Facebook, search for NB Historical Fiction, and follow us on Twitter at NewBooksHistFic. If you do, you'll see each time we post a new interview. You can also find out more about me, my website, and my books at blog.cplesley.com. where I upload expanded posts about the interviews and in general discuss history, historical fiction, and the rapidly changing publishing industry. Goodbye until my next conversation about new books in historical fiction.